the show that's focused on investing strategies for today's needs and tomorrow's goals. This is Bucket Strategy Investing, presented by the Wealth Advisors at Lucia Capital Group. Now, here are Johnny Dean and Rick the Professor Plum.
Yeah, welcome back to the program. It is all about, guess what, Bucket Strategy Investing. We're here with the Brain Trust. You've got the one show. It gives you the strategies you need to help you get to, and I hope through, retirement. It's going to be a lively one yet again today, perhaps as lively as yesterday. We're still bouncing about that. A lot of things to talk about. Standing by, ready to crank out more quality programming and expert advice. Can I say that? Sure, why not? This hour, we'll be talking about something that many people have been convinced to do, whether it's right for them or not, and that is buying real estate in their IRA. Now, you've probably heard the sales pitches. You probably heard them where they tell you that if you buy your real estate in your IRA, you can defer all the taxes, or maybe pay no taxes at all if you put it in a Roth. And then why they say it's the best move you're ever going to make. Well, I would say it's not. Okay, we're going to tell you why coming up. Hey, we're also going to have Steve Allendort, our loan financial planner. He'll be here to talk about some of these new jumbo loan programs. And he's also going to answer this question, is it a good idea to dispute items on your credit report? Well, according to Steve, the answer may surprise you, especially if you're getting a loan shortly. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. You got a question for the Brain Trust? Call right now. Our studio lines are open, 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. The hour is just getting started, so call now. Emails, you get those to us at wealthed.com at the Find Your Answer link near the top of the page. Professor Rick Plum, he's our main Brain Trust advisor, here with me again, courtesy of the wonderful people at Lucia Capital Group who bring you this hour of the program. If you need a bucket strategy put together, one that's specifically designed for you, one that fits your goals, you can call the professor or anyone at Lucia Capital Group at this number, 800-644-1150. You know, preparing yourself for whatever might happen, and anything could happen. That's one of the keys to a successful retirement plan. So you need to make sure you have a plan for whatever might happen down the line. And you don't know what it is, but be ready for it. Once again, the number at Lucia Capital Group, 800-644-1150. Our number on air, 877-PLANNER. You know that by now, 877-752-6637. We do have plenty of room here on the phones at the top of the hour. As I said, Steve Allendort will join us in about 15 minutes talking about mortgages. Well, we'll get started on this anyway. So real estate in an IRA, I contend, and maybe you do too, Professor Plum, that the only reason anybody would suggest to somebody else that they should buy real estate in their IRA for the most part is because they have some real estate that they want to sell them, and they know that the money is in the IRA.
I don't know if it's the only reason, but I've seen that as being a very driving reason behind it. You know, there is a place for real estate in a portfolio. A lot of people have done very well with real estate. A lot of people want to try their hand at doing well with real estate. But unfortunately, most people, the majority of their money is in their IRA. So if the majority of your money is in your IRA and you want to deal with real estate, well, guess where you're going to end up dealing with that real estate? Inside your IRA. And if I'm somebody who makes my living selling real estate, and I need you to buy some real estate, you wanted to buy some real estate, you've come to me for help, and all of your money's in, or the majority of your money's in your IRA, I don't have a problem selling it to you in your IRA. There's nothing illegal or anything of that nature. It's not like it's the worst thing in the world, but is it as good as it's made out to be buying real estate in your IRA?
Yeah, and you know, there are advantages to having real estate, as you said, in a portfolio. The specific tax advantages to real estate in your portfolio and owning it personally.
There potentially are different types of advantages of owning real estate. One is that they are an alternative to stocks and bonds. They tend to act differently. They act at different times. They go up and down at different times in the stock market, different. So from a portfolio allocation standpoint, the real estate does have a place in a portfolio. But a lot of people think about real estate primarily from the tax advantages. I mean, how many times have we heard, you got to have rental real estate to be able to help you, you know, lessen the tax impact? Well, for some people, that's a true statement. For others, it's not a true statement. But there are advantages for real estate when I own it personally. When I own real estate, I get, you know, rental property. I buy a property and I rent it out. I have cash flow. Hopefully, I have tenants and cash flow coming in. I'm able to shelter that cash flow by using the interest on the mortgage, if I have a mortgage, the property taxes, But those are typical deductions, but also maintenance, repairs, and then there's this other thing called depreciation. So I may, you know, buy a property and rent it out for $1,500, $2,000 a month. My expenses to, you know, to buy and to maintain that property may create I may end up paying out of pocket, you know, $1,200 a month. So I'm showing about $300 a month net positive cash flow. So I get a little bit of cash flow, but somebody else is paying my mortgage for me. That's pretty cool. I like that idea. And hopefully I'll get some appreciation over the years, and leverage does help that aspect.
Meaning borrowing and, money. And using that.
But in the meantime, I get a little bit of cash flow. So I've got this, you know, $3,000, $4,000 a year positive cash flow from this little rental. But I don't have to necessarily show that $3,000 or $4,000 of taxable income on my tax return. First off, I was renting it for $1,800, and now I'm only showing $3,000 of cash flow, $4,000 of cash flow. But this depreciation, this non-cash flow item, allows me to reduce that number for my taxes. And maybe instead, you know, I can wipe out that $3,000 or $4,000 and another $3,000 or $4,000 on top of that. So I can show a negative taxable event even though I have a positive cash flow. And so that's where we get these tax advantages from owning real estate. I may actually have positive cash flow, but I get a negative event on my tax return, which helps me, for some people, offset other incomes. That's a good thing, right? Now, if you make too much income, you don't get this advantage of the negative side of the house. You can use it to offset the income from that particular rental, so I can have a positive cash flow from the real estate without having to pay any current income tax on it. But that makes a lot of sense. Now, the disadvantage of owning real estate in an IRA is I don't get to use the depreciation because it's a tax deferred account. None of those issues come into play. Cash flow comes in and it's not taxed because it's in an IRA. The expenses, they're not deductible because it's in an IRA. I don't get the same treatment. But the advantage of that is, and this is John and I were talking about this earlier, one of the biggest advantages to owning real estate inside of an IRA, I don't have to do the tax return. Mm-hmm. For all of those out there that have real estate and you file your Schedule E and have sold real estate and had to recapture depreciation and all that, it's a moot point inside of an IRA, with the exception of debt financing gain. I don't have to worry about it so much. Did I have to recapture my depreciation? No, because I never took it in the first place. It's in an IRA. It's a tax-deferred investment.
In fact, you don't even have to, when it's an IRA, you don't even have to say anything about it. I mean, you sell it, and that's it.
It's
and
in the IRA.
Doesn't have to show up on your tax return at all.
The only time it has an issue is if I sell it with a loan on it, and I have debt-financed gain. You know, I buy a place for $400,000, and I use a $300,000 loan on it. And it's an interest-only loan for my little simplistic explanation here. And 10 years goes by, and the property grows to $500,000, grew $100,000, went from $400,000 to $500,000. And I sell it. My IRA sells it, but it still has a $300,000 mortgage against it. The mortgage was originally 75% of the purchase price. So guess what? 75% of the gain is attributable to the loan. Now, the accounting is slightly off here, but just the percentage of gain attributable to the loan in the IRA becomes a taxable event to the IRA. Not to you personally, to the IRA. Now, the IRA has its own tax account. It does not have a 10% bracket. It has the other ones, but it hits the 39.6% bracket really quickly. So you're going to pay in a very high tax bracket on that debt finance gain. So you really want to pay it off before you sell it.
So when you buy it personally, you have all kinds of things. You have depreciation, as you said. You can save on that. You have the potential for capital gains tax treatment upon sale.
Correct.
You do have to do a tax return on it, but
you have to do a tax return. You may have some depreciation recapture. So having it inside the IRA makes things simple. Having it outside the IRA makes things a little more complicated. Until you sell it, and then when you sell it, mm-hmm. you have ordinary income. When you distribute cash from your IRA, it's ordinary income. So you've got to, you know, if I hold on to a property until I die, step up in basis. There's lots of advantages to owning real estate personally,
yes.
with a little disadvantage of the tax returns.
Yeah, but think about it though. You inherit a property from somebody else. You die. Your heirs inherit the property. It was $100,000 when you bought it. It's worth $600,000 now. You die, they inherit it. They now have a new basis of $600,000.
And they can re-depreciate it. But if they inherit the IRA.
But if they inherit the IRA, it's still at the $100,000
level. So what is the selling point behind having it in the IRA? The tax-free growth, not tax-free, the tax-deferred growth. But the reality is, if I'm buying it in my personal account, how much in taxes am I actually paying as I go along? I'm renting it out, but I'm using the property and the expenses to offset the income. So I'm not paying a lot of taxes on it while it's growing. So the tax-deferred growth of the IRA is not that big of an advantage because I'm getting a very good tax-efficient growth from it personally. The problem is when you get older, you sell it, you take it out, now we have an issue.
Now we have an issue, and when you get into things like required minimum distribution at age 70 and a half, that's where it really becomes an issue. And by that, I don't mean a fun issue. We're going to excuse Professor Plum until the bottom of the hour. We will talk more about this after the bottom of the hour. In the meantime, we're going to bring in our loan financial planner, Steve Allendorf, going to talk to us about mortgages, jumbo mortgages, and your credit report. Johnny Dean, Professor Plum, the Brain Trust returns on Bucket Strategy Investing. Bucket Strategy Investing, bringing you the best in money information and the best in the Brain Trust guest department. Once again, Steve Allendorf, our loan financial planner from Rancho Financial, joins us as he does most every Tuesday here. You can reach him at loan, L-O-A-N, loanfinancialplanner.com. Great way to get in touch with him, or at 888-563-1070 if you still like to use the telephone. Steve Allendorf, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us. So rates, especially if you got a lot of money down, you've got some decent.
Yeah, I mean, the last week and a half, there's been just a little bit of upward pressure
every day
on rates. Today, we're actually getting a little bit of rebound.
Good.
They haven't moved too much. I mean, 30-year fixed rates conforming,
yeah. Which
in most cases, 4.17 or less, mm-hmm. with good equity. Rate and term, you can get as low as 3.6, 3.7, mm-hmm. go all the way up to maybe 4.1 based on credit score, loan to value if you're taking cash out. The 7-year loan that we've talked about, conforming 3.25 to 3.7, again, wow. Based on your scenario. And I'm giving you these ranges because it's so important when you see rates on the internet. They're luring you in. It may not apply to your situation.
In fact,
so be aware of that.
The best rate they give you only applies to a small subset of people.
Correct.
Right?
15-year, 3% to maybe 3.25, 3.5. The jumbo loan, still really aggressive. And a jumbo loan, you can get a jumbo loan with above the conforming limit. So anything above 4.17 could be considered jumbo.
Sure.
30-year fixed rates, 3.6 to 4%. 7-year with, 40% equity, purchase, refinance, as low as 3%. On a 7-year, and government loans still between 3.25 and 3.5 to 3.6.
Now, how much down are you talking about generally with these kinds of rates on these loans?
With the lowest rates,
yeah.
You're probably looking 25 to 40% down, or having that in equity to get the absolute lowest rates on the market.
Yeah, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Now, certain jumbo, there's some news on or some things to talk about on jumbo loans with regard to how much money you have down and mortgage insurance, which is often required if you don't have, say, 20% down or equity.
Correct. And for a period of time, with the jumbo loans, we were only allowed to do 20% down. I mean, there are some lenders you could do a first and maybe do a line of credit.
You mean you couldn't get one yourself?
For a small period of time, that when the market crashed, jumbo lenders backed out, then they came back in the market. Uh-huh. We were looking at 20% down. You needed 20%.
Yeah.
Got a lender right now. Loan amount up to $900,000, whether you're doing a purchase or a rate and term refinance. On a 7-year fixed, 3.5%, 3.6%, has mortgage insurance. But that mortgage insurance is only about 0.6%. So when you take the rate plus the mortgage insurance, put it together, your effective interest rate is maybe only 4.1%, 4.2%.
Yeah, which is, by the way, how much you're paying. It's not from a tax standpoint, not necessarily how much you're deducting.
Correct,
yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
But that's your
but
effective
that's your,
rate
what you care about is
with
what
your
you're
rate
paying. Yeah,
plus
exactly.
The percent rate on the mortgage insurance. So you can get into a purchase up to $1 million with $100,000 down.
Wow.
Or let's say that you have a higher end property, and again, it could be $500,000-$600,000. The market crashed, you had a first, or you had a first and a line of credit, you were underwater, and now it's gotten to the point where you may have 10% equity. You're thinking to yourself, I gotta wait till I have 20%. But if you have 10% equity and you've got a first that might be in the mid to high fours or in the fives, because I'm still seeing those loans with people that haven't been able to refinance.
They're stuck.
Or you've got a line of credit that has been frozen or you no longer can draw against. If you haven't taken draws on that, I can take the first, the line of credit, merge it together into one loan, fixed for 7 years with an effective rate of about 4.1 or 4.2, inclusive of the mortgage insurance.
Yes, which now does, if eventually the market rebounds or you can make your payments down to where you can get up to, say, 20%, can that mortgage
eventually,
insurance
you're
go
you're looking
away?
2 to 5 years,
yeah,
where you can petition to get that mortgage insurance eliminated.
You have to petition, though, to have it eliminated.
They don't just say, oh, geez, we've gone to this five-year period of time and we've done all these calculations for you, and we're going to eliminate your mortgage insurance.
Look at us. No, that's not going to happen. That's not going to
happen.
You've got to be proactive. Okay, well, let's say you have a little bit more. Instead of 10%, maybe you got 15%.
Yeah, I have a great lender with 15% down. And I priced a loan out with a loan amount up to $2 million, and they potentially would be able to do more than that. With as little as 15% as a down payment or 15% equity on a refinance, if we're doing rate and term, we're not pulling cash out, at 30-year fixed, 3.875. Now, you'll end up paying a point on that loan. I generally don't do loans with points. Mm-hmm. I always think when I calculate the numbers out, it's better to keep it at 0 points or, you know, a quarter point, 3/8 of a point. That point is buying out the mortgage insurance.
Oh.
So the advantage is it could save you, you know, on a, let's say, a $500,000 purchase, 20% down would be $100,000. 15% down would be 75. So if that 25,000, having that left in the bank, or maybe you don't even have that, if it costs an extra $3,000 or $4,000 to be able to get into that mortgage or to refinance a property, if you've got a much higher interest rate, this is a great program to take a look at.
Oh, sure. I paid mortgage insurance briefly 17, 18 years ago when I bought my house. I wanted the house, and I had to do that. But I hated it. I just seemed like I was writing it for nothing.
Yeah, on the conforming side, you know, up to 417 in most areas, and certain, mm-hmm. and there's some areas that have high balance limits mm-hmm. that go above that, we could actually do 5 or 10% down, build the MI into the interest rate. So you pay maybe an eighth, quarter, 3/8 of a more in rate.
Right.
You eliminate the mortgage insurance. So it's on the loan for the full term, but most people in that upper end are earning more than $100,000 plus per year. So if they had mortgage insurance, they wouldn't be able to write it off. So by having it built into the interest rate,
which you can deduct,
deduct the interest.
Yes. Okay, now credit disputes. Let's talk about that because I mentioned that here at the top of the hour.
Yeah, a lot of people think that, you know, hey, if I think I'm being wronged or I really don't feel I owe it, I'm going to go ahead and throw in a dispute on the credit bureau so other creditors are going to look at it to see that I'm disputing it, that it may not be accurate. As far as doing a mortgage loan, it's probably the worst thing you can do at this point. Because if there's a dispute on your credit report, that dispute has to be cleared up prior to you closing the mortgage loan. And in some cases, Freddie Mac, which we use a lot because on self-employed borrowers, mm-hmm. they'll allow me to go off of 1 year tax returns. People are doing better now. I'm getting much better. I saw better returns in 14 than I did in 13. I'm now seeing better returns in 15 than 14 on self-employed people or corporations.
Good.
Freddie Mac allows us to use 1 year, which can be a great benefit to somebody who is building their business.
Sure.
Maybe didn't have such a good year in 13 or 14.
But if you have a dispute.
But if they have a dispute on the credit report, I can't even get a reading through the system on an approval. We have to get those disputes cleared up before we can actually get you through the system and get it approved. I have ways that we can potentially work it, but it's a lot of work in order to get it done. So you want to get off your high horse. I'm a principal guy, but when it comes to credit, make your payment, even if you don't agree with it. If you got something going on, clear it up on the side. Don't dispute it. It'll make it much more difficult to get a home loan.
That's why it pays to have somebody who's seen all the stuff that can happen.
I've seen it all.
You have. Steve Allador, we'll talk to you next week. If you need to get in touch with him, at 888-563-1070 or loanfinancialplanner.com. Thanks again, Steve.
Always a pleasure.
Brain Trust continues right after this. Money questions here on the program. Bucket Strategy Investing, 877-PLANNER. We'll take your calls right now, 877-752-6637. Any money question you have, we're here to answer it for you. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum from Lucia Capital Group, taking you to the top of the hour. And don't forget, later on, and every Tuesday, by the way, I should mention this, every Tuesday at WealthEd.com, you can learn about Social Security. We get a lot of questions on Social Security. Naturally, we try to answer all of them, but some of them just don't, we don't have time to get to. So we do this on the Social Security show. Really, what we don't have time to always get into is the nitty-gritty of it, the strategies, the laws and all that stuff, and the limited time we have here. That's why we have the Social Security show every Tuesday, 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern time, and it's only at WealthEd.com, our website, Wealth, W-E-A-L-T-H, WealthEd.com. So you can learn about Social Security, get your questions answered through both email and voicemail form right there at the Social Security show. I'll be with Professor Rick Plum once again every Tuesday. 877-PLANNER is our number, P-L-A-N-N-E-R, on the air, 877-752-6637. Let's move along next to Dwayne in Springfield, Missouri. Dwayne, thanks for hanging on. How can we help you today?
I have a Social Security question.
Hey, how about that?
I took my Social Security benefit when I was at full retirement age, and then I went on suspension so my wife could collect her spousal benefit.
Okay.
I intend to wait till I'm 70, which is in about 10 months.
Okay.
What I want to know is, this is a hell of a time to ask, but will her being on as a collecting spousal benefits have any effect on my ultimate waiting till 70 benefit?
No, your benefit is your benefit. Whether one person's pulling a benefit from yours, or you know, you've got kids on it, you got you know six ex-wives, it doesn't matter. Your benefit is your benefit. Having her take
much.
A benefit from you does not reduce your benefit in any way, shape, or form.
Now, I have one other quick question. It's kind of a math question. If I know what my full benefit would have been when I was at 66,
sure.
Is this some math that I can use to figure out what my extended benefit will be in 10 months when I'm 70?
Sure. Multiply it by 32%, 132% of your original.
What
was your benefit?
Yeah, what's your benefit, Dwayne?
About $2,000.
Okay, $2,680.
A month.
Or $2,640. Figure about $2,650 if your full retirement age benefit was $2,000, multiply that by 1.32, 8% a year, 4 years, 4 times 8 is 32. It's not exact. This is a rough way to do it, but it's pretty close.
So there's no compounding then.
There is, and that's why I'm not taking into that consideration. But the easy way is just do it by 32.
But it should be at least that. Anyway.
And it's you know it's actually 0.2% per month, which is 8% per year, 32% over 4 years. But you can get close to that number. So the reality is you can show the compounding, but then when you start receiving it, it's going to be less than that because you're going to see the net check after the Social Security or the Medicare check payment has come out. So you're going to go, wait a minute, where'd my money go?
Oh, yes. Oh, I didn't think about that. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Dwayne, thank you for the call. Yeah, there is that component of it, too. What happens is when you figure out how much you're going to get at full retirement age, whether it's you know, it was in his case you know 3 years ago, or if it's going to be you know 10 years from now for you. This is what they're telling you you would get, but that full retirement age benefit isn't based on, the number you're seeing is not based on cost of living adjustments and all that stuff.
There's other things that go into it, but you know, the easy way to calculate it is just to look at it, just like if I take it at 62, if I do my projection and it shows that I'll receive $2,000 a month at full retirement age, assuming full retirement age is 66, but I'm only 62 and I wanted to take it at 62, how much would I be able to receive at 62? If I don't want to go onto the website and do anything of that nature, basically, you're going to get 75% of that number. Is it an exact 75 because of the way they do things? No, but it's close. All we're doing is trying to get close to what the number looks like so we can do some basic planning. So if I thought I was going to get 2,000 at full retirement age, again, this assumes full retirement age of 66, Then 62 is roughly $1,500 a month, 75% of the 62 number. And age 70 is 132% of the 66 number. So there's my benefit range within reason in that area. The numbers are different if your full retirement age is different. Now, the original calculation for determining what they call your primary insurance amount, your full retirement age benefit, is the same calculation, but it starts at 62 or 66, 66 and 2 months or whatever. My full retirement age is 67. So if I wanted to take it early at 62, it's not a 25% haircut. It's a 30% haircut. And if I wait until age 70, it's not 8% a year for 4 years, because my full retirement age is 67. It's only 8% a year for 3 years, because it stops building at age 70. So it's 124% on the upside. Just, you know, basic math.
Yeah, it is. And people whose retirement age years ago was 60, full retirement age was 65, theirs was higher. It grew at a higher rate, but the reduction was less.
Yeah.
And so anyway. All right, 877-PLANNER. Want to get to a couple more calls. Let's see. Bill is up next, Houston, Texas. Hello, Bill.
Hello, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Okay, here's the soap opera. My girlfriend did a 401 loan, and then she left the company. Well, she was 355 when she made the loan, and she left. She was after 55. To me, in my mind, the money is due, 60 days after she terminates?
Roughly.
Okay, well, her CPA told her that there's still a 10% penalty because she did the loan before. And to me, the monies are not due until after she was 55.
I'm on your side of the camp that, you know, she took a loan out whatever year it was, year or two ago, but she terminated employment in the year she turned 55 or older. So
right.
Did she terminate in 2015 or 16?
Oh, that was a couple of years ago.
Oh, like it's a couple of years. So they're just coming back to her now?
What's that?
They're just coming back to her now?
No. It's 3 years will be up April 15. I want her to amend her taxes because she paid $900 in penalties, and I don't think she should have to pay.
Oh.
My understanding is the way you do it. The distribution occurred when she terminated. The distribution occurred.
Well, that's what I'm thinking.
That's the way I have read it, and that's the way I've talked to people about it, you know, doing it. But your accountant, their accountant, is the driving force behind the tax return. So you've got to get your accountant or your tax preparer to do it. Now, it's when the distribution occurs, and the distribution occurred after she quit work. She quit work in the year she turned 55 or later. My opinion, which means nothing when it comes to tax court, is that there's no 10% penalty.
Right. That's what I thought. Well, she didn't. He's a CPA, and he didn't. She took more money out afterwards, and he was still going to write her up for 10% penalty after 55. And I told her that ain't right. And he went over the ribbon through the woods with the IRS, and then finally figured out that there's no 10% penalty afterwards.
Well, yeah. So he may have screwed up the first one too. Then
that's all I'm thinking.
Hey, $900 is $900. Yeah. Take it to a different CPA and ask them their opinion.
Yeah, $900 after tax dollars, if
right.
You know what I mean.
$900 is $900, man.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah,
thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, okay, Bill, thanks for the call. You seem to be, we're in your camp. I don't see why there would be. Discuss for a second what we're talking about with regards to age 55, Professor Plum.
Most everybody knows about the age 59 and a half rule, that if you take money out of your retirement plan before you reach 59 and a half, there's a penalty, a premature distribution penalty of 10%. There's a change in that, though. If you take money directly from a company that you worked for, their retirement plan in the year you turn 55 or later, if you terminated employment in the year you turn 55 or later. So if I'm 56 years old and I quit and I've got a 401k at the company I just left from, I can have them send me money directly. Yes, it'll be taxable because it's always taxable. But the money that comes to me, as long as I terminated in the year I turned 55 or later, there's no premature distribution penalty. If I roll the 401k to an IRA and then take money out of the IRA, I'm only 56. Now it doesn't matter because it's coming from an IRA. That's a flat 59 and a half. I'd have to do some kind of substantial equal payment plan or some other reason to get away from the penalty. But one of the exceptions to the penalty is if you terminate employment and take distributions directly from that particular company's 401k, and if you're 55 or older when you terminate employment. That doesn't mean I can quit when I'm 52 and wait until I'm 55 to take money out. That doesn't qualify. I have to quit, terminate, be fired, whatever the stop my employment one way or another in the year I turn 55 or later. And it only applies to that company that I was working for up to the point where I was 55 or older. I can't have a 401k from a previous employer or that I want to take out. Mm-hmm. That's a different plan. I didn't quit them. I didn't terminate that employment at 55. I terminated from them at 45 or something.
I suppose if you had two jobs and you had two 401ks and you quitted them both at age 56 at the same time, you could access both of those because technically you...
And it is the year you turn 55, so I don't actually have to be 55 when I quit because, you know, my birthday could be in December and I may be, you know, 54 and I quit in April. I'm in the year I turn 55. I'm good to avoid the penalty.
That's it. Okay, we got to take a break here, but we got a little bit of room on the phones. 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R. We'll go to Ellis up next right after the break. So, Ellis, hang on there in Palm Beach. We'll get to your question when we come back, but we still have a couple of lines open. Grab them while you can because the phones get busy. 877-PLANNER. Johnny Dean, Professor Rick Plum. This is Bucket Strategy Investing. This is Bucket Strategy Investing. Just a tiny bit of room on the phones. 877-PLANNER, P-L-A-N-N-E-R, if you want to get in touch with the Brain Trust. And there's another hour just ahead of the program, so a whole lot more to come. Things that we still haven't talked about, including some more on this idea of buying real estate in an IRA. And speaking of money questions, which we answer here on the program, you can also get your money questions answered in person at one of the many, many workshops that are still to come here, featuring Professor Plum from Lucia Capital Group, Terry Keyes, and the local advisors, the Brain Trust, we call them. Next workshop is going to be this Saturday in Phoenix, Arizona, Saturday, March 12th, 9 o'clock in the morning. Join the Brain Trust as they talk about retirement income strategies, a lot of strategies, helping out so that you don't potentially run out of money before you run out of time. So this Saturday, Professor Plum and the gang in Phoenix. After that, it'll be Portland, Oregon. That's Saturday, March 19th. And then Houston, Texas, a couple of weeks after that, April 9th. There will be more following that in the month of April. If you want to sign up, you go to wealthed.com, wealthed.com, our website, and you can sign up there. It's all free. Meet the Brain Trust, get your money questions answered, and learn all about retirement income strategies, which is paramount to most retirees. They want to make sure they don't run out of money. Okay, 877-PLANNER. Ellis, give us a call back. I know you had a question. We'll put you up. In the meantime, let's go to Jerry up next in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hello, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 66 and retired and received my final long-term incentive payment last year. Can I open an IRA and get the deduction?
When you say that's a long-term incentive, when was the last time you actually worked?
July of 2014.
Okay, then. So this was more like a deferred comp or something that they were paying you out over a period of time.
Yes, exactly.
And you didn't work anywhere near the 2015. You'd quit work 6 months before it. Technically,
right.
No, this doesn't qualify. Deferred comp payments of any type do not satisfy the earned income rule. Now, are you single or married?
Single.
Okay. Yeah, it's not going to qualify for an IRA contribution.
Okay. Well, I tried.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else he can do? He wants to get money inside of an IRA.
No.
Nothing?
No.
Go back to work?
Well, he can't go back to work for 2015. It's
well,
done.
Well, no, not for 2015, but I'm just trying to help you out here, Jerry.
Most likely on your W-2, there's a code on it somewhere that says it's deferred income, not from current earned income.
Okay.
So the IRS would know.
Okay. Can't put it past them, huh?
They're pretty good at it. I mean,
that's one of the things. Somehow, I think the computer catches that before anybody at the IRS does. So, if
right.
it weren't for the computers, Jerry, they may not catch it. But I would never want to take a chance with that.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But I figured I'd better double check because I was trying to get past the total AGI numbers and everything else. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you worked up until December 31st and you got a paycheck in January. You could, you know,
make an argument.
You could, you know, say that's my normal pay for the work I did, but income is only, I mean, it's deferred income doesn't qualify for a supporting a contribution to an IRA.
Okay.
All right,
Very
Jerry.
I just owe extra Fed tax then.
Yeah, but you would have voted at some point anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
It's only a deferral.
Right. Okay, thanks for your help.
All right, Jerry, thank you for the call. I wish we had better news on that. Yeah, and this came up a couple days ago. Maybe it was yesterday. Maybe it was this hour. I can't recall what it is. Some of the rules for contributing to an IRA, Professor Plum, if you wanted to get money into it, say, for last year, there's...
If you had earned income last year, you still have time to make a contribution mm-hmm. to an IRA for last year. But the key is you had to have earned income, earned during the year.
Yes, and that's where the sticking point is, I think, or where people say, well, wait a minute, though. This is simply deferred compensation. I didn't take it back in 2014 or whatever it is.
When you earned it.
Yeah, and so why can I not, I didn't take it then.
Well,
if
the question
paid
we had,
me, I would have been able to take it.
The question we had last week or the week before had to do with the W-2 that a person received from exercising stock options. And it is... Basically, it looks like, for all intents and purposes, earned income because it comes on a W-2. But he hadn't worked for 4 or 5 years. It was income technically that he earned way back when he was working, and he finally got paid for it now. That doesn't – a deferred comp doesn't – anything that's deferred after when you were working doesn't support the IRA contribution. That's just one of those things the IRS says. Why? I don't know. That's just what they said. It's still a W-2 in my mind. It's still earned income in my mind, but my mind doesn't count when it comes to tax law.
Well, I mean, it's a lovely opinion, but if you're going to try to argue it,
you're going to lose.
You're probably going to lose because that's the way it works. All right, 877-PLANNER. I want to get to a quick email here before the top of the hour. Let's see. Linda in Dallas, Texas. Rick, the professor, explained income-related adjustments to Medicare deductions from Social Security, which is subsidized, so it makes sense. How do they justify doing the same to my Part D coverage when I bought from the insurer? Well, first of all, what's she talking about here?
Well, she's talking about the means testing of Medicare Part B, where when we get over certain income levels, retirees or active employees that are over 65 on Medicare, paying Medicare Part B and D, we have to pay more for our Medicare premiums if we make over certain income thresholds. Single person, $85,000, married couple filing a joint return, $170,000 of adjusted gross income. We get to pay more for our Medicare Part B. The reason is the government is subsidizing the majority of the premium for Medicare, and they say if you're making a lot of money, then you deserve to pay more of that premium. The government will subsidize less of it for those very rich people that make more than those certain thresholds. How much more depends on how far over the threshold you go. It's about $50, just a little under $50 a month if you go over the 170 at just the first threshold there. So it does start adding up. That's what, $600 a year, something like that, more for your mm-hmm. Medicare. Doesn't change your coverage or anything. You just get the chance to pay more. But she's saying, I can almost understand that because the government is subsidizing the premium on Medicare Part B. And so letting a high income wage earner pay more of it, you can almost see the rationale on that. But Medicare Part D, the prescription drug, is paid for out of her pocket. We don't know of any subsidizing that's going on. She buys it directly from the insurance company. So how do they go about? And they do means test the Medicare Part D premium will
go
up too. And the only answer I can give you is because they said so. I don't.
I hate doing that.
I don't have a good answer for why they can do it to the Medicare Part D premium. As far as I know, they're not subsidizing that one. They're just saying because you're an evil, mean, rich person, you get to pay more.
Well, and Part D was actually, that was the most recent
It came
part
in
of Medicare.
The Bush 43.
Yeah. 10 years ago, something like that?
Give or take.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's your answer. Wish we had a more...
I don't have a good answer for why they do it.
It's just the
that
way
they
it
do.
Is. Yes, all right. Well, we've got other answers coming up in another hour, and we could be able to explain the why behind them. But in the meantime, if you want to talk to Professor or any of the Brain Trust advisors from Lucia Capital Group, you can get in touch with them at their off-air number, 800-644-1150. 800-644-1150. Talk to them about your retirement plan or about any of the topics that we discuss on this program. That's right. Another hour is just ahead. Stick around. Buckett Strategy Investing.
Information presented should not be considered specific tax, legal, or investment advice. You should always seek counsel of the appropriate advisor prior to making any investment decision. All investments are subject to risk, including the loss of principal. There is no guarantee that any investing or financial planning strategy will be profitable, provide protection from loss, or meet its stated objectives. Investment advisor representatives of Lucia Capital Group are also registered representatives of and offer securities through Lucia Securities, LLC, a registered broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. John Dean is an associated person with Lucia Securities, LLC. In the information presented, the opinions and views expressed are subject to change without notice and may not come to pass. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of skill or training.